You have to go through moments of practice for those accomplishments. Let me try and be the small change in my own way. I know what I don't know, but I embrace it and try and figure it out.
On November 6th, 2023, OpenAI announced that they would be rolling out GPTs, the ability for anyone, anywhere to create their own GenAI chatbot, uniquely tailored to their point of view, no code necessary. On November 8th, Q Hamirami got access to the ability to create GPTs. He immediately went to work. By November 10th, Q had three different GPTs that he had built, was excited about, and was now sharing them with the world online, that used the power of GenAI to automate some of the repetitive tasks that hit people teams. By November 11th, inspired by the opportunity here, Q put out a call on LinkedIn, inviting any people leaders around the globe who were interested in joining a community of folks who wanted to be really passionate and strategic about leveraging this technology to drive their teams to come on board. In 48 hours, the team was 100 people strong, covered with people leaders from all across the globe interested in leveraging GenAI to advance and accelerate their teams. That little team grew into the People GPT community, what is arguably now the world's largest collection of senior people leaders passionately leveraging GenAI to advance the capabilities of their team in real time. Now, that whirlwind is kind of business as usual for Q. This is the same guy who, in the summer of 2020, amidst the global pause and pivot of the pandemic, spearheaded Airbnb's groundbreaking journey with their digital nomad program, which eventually turned into their Work From Anywhere program, a blueprint for the ways that corporations could embrace a new nomad culture to address the needs of their employees and drastically increase their access to the global talent pool. Today, in the debate for return to office, it's often easy to forget that the idea that people could ever work outside of an office was relatively unknown about 4 years ago. And Q and his team were at the forefront of the real logistical blueprint to make that happen. That is Q, always curious, always collaborative, and always super fast with the execution. Q is a beacon of innovation and adaptability, and he brings over two decades of rich, multidisciplinary experience to the fore. From engineering to finance and beyond, his journey is a mosaic of roles that underscore his intrinsic ability to empathize, connect, and lead with a forward-thinking mindset. Q currently steers the ship at Paper as their chief people and communications officer. He continues to challenge the status quo, advocating for a remote-first approach that champions flexibility and choice, underpinned by his belief in the transformative power of technology to enhance human productivity and connection. This episode will dive into the essence of resilience and endurance. We'll look back on how Q's start as a competitive swimmer influenced his approach to competition and discipline. We'll look at his multifaceted career that spans the corridors of Airbnb to the innovative educational platform Paper. We'll reflect on the dynamic shifts happening in the workplace post-pandemic, the strategic foresight that's required to embrace remote work, and then we'll deep dive into the educational initiatives that aim to reshape the learning landscape for K-12 students. So join me as we unravel Q's philosophy on leadership, his visionary approach to the future of work, and his relentless pursuit of personal growth and societal betterment. Q is a powerhouse. And I'm excited for you to dive right in. Let's get started. As you think about the kind of leader you've grown into today, are there any childhood experiences that you feel were really formative in either giving a lens or values that show up in your leadership today?
So one of the fun facts, if you will, of my childhood was I started swimming at a very early age when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I swam professionally till I was 16 years old in India. And I swam for the state level and I also qualified for the national level in India. One of my key traits today that has helped me continue to push the boundaries and myself has been my continued resilience and endurance in bearing with the pain to get through an initiative, get through time, be it our roles that we are in, to get on the other side and feel that sense of accomplishment and fruition and just overall satisfaction. And I think it goes back to when I used to swim, you know, obviously when I was competitive swimming, the races that I was good at were short distance, but the practice we would do was 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the evening, every single day. I think that is what stuck with me, that you have to go through moments of practice for those accomplishments that may seem like they just happened over time because you just did stuff, but it's all the hard work that comes to fruition in a split second sometimes. You know, in my role today as well as chief people officer and working through other business with other business leaders, it's a constant endurance driven resilience to do the right thing that eventually clicks.
Do you think over that time, what happens is that you experience less pain than your peers, or that you interpret that pain differently? What do you think is the root of that pain tolerance?
Everything is learnable is my philosophy. If someone really wants to try and put their mind to it or is dedicated and motivated towards it. I think for me, the pain tolerance is one dimension of agility that keeps me going, right? So the pain and the endurance coupled with my agility to always learn and be curious and try new things and deal with ambiguity and deal in unknown environments just keeps me going. And maybe I think it's two things. One, it's that uncertainty of how things will play out really excites me. On the other end, it's also the fact that the pain or the resistance that you may get that you have to work through the pain with is a motivation factor for me. If someone tells me this is not possible, or it's way too hard, or it's way too complex, that is fuel for my ambition. Like that is what keeps me going. So when you couple all these things, right, to your point, like, am I going through less pain or others? I think I'm probably going through more pain, but it does not necessarily feel just on one dimensional of pain or torture, for lack of better words, because it's fueled by ambition. It's fueled by the ambiguity and unknown that I'm going into that space. Throughout my career, it's been every 5 years I've taken a right turn that I've never done before. That keeps it going. So I think it's a weird but interesting combination of ambition, people telling you no, which is enough to fuel that ambition. And then that eventually gets you to power through the pain to get the fruition on the other end.
I wonder if you could paint in broad strokes the journey. You're an engineer by training.
Yep.
Today, you're a chief people officer of an ed tech company. And somewhere in between there was Airbnb, there was workplace design. Kind of walk me through what that journey looked like. And I'm curious, what are some of the things you think that you've picked up along the way from each of those stops?
So I studied electrical engineering, as you mentioned. And I think one of the things I realized towards the end of my undergraduate degree was that I really enjoyed being with people. I did not enjoy being in a lab by myself building a circuit, for example. I enjoyed being with people to have fun, to build things, to cause commotion, you name it. But the energy from people was what I missed. So I started off my career actually in manufacturing on a factory floor with GE, helping individuals that had been on a specific machine in a factory floor for about 30 years. I was a 19-year-old kid there helping them make their lives better. Right then, I realized that it's building relationships, it's understanding perspectives, it's empathizing with people to build those small bridges of trust to then get your eventual work and relationship to go. And then when I graduated, which was 2 years later, I ended up working at Deloitte in finance transformation. And why did I work in finance? Just because I'd never done it before. And it was opportunity. So a lot of this is my dedication and desire to learn something new, but also the right place, right time, because I believe it's a combination of both. So I did 5 years of finance, which was ended up becoming, as I was working for CFOs and COOs, it ended up becoming at the intersection of people, finance, and technology, because a lot of the transformations were at the intersection of people, process, and technology. After doing that for 5 years, I had this itch of doing something more broad stroked, in the sense where I did not want to be just the ops guy or just the finance guy or just the technology guy. So I went over to Aon and I did global strategy and innovation across 11 countries in Europe and South America. And along that journey, I realized that people can make or break the best process of best technology you have. It does not matter if you don't have the right people in the right roles, because I'd seen very well-planned projects fail because they didn't have the right people in the right role. And I'd seen very loosely planned, relatively, projects succeed because the people had the agility and they would adapt and they would figure it out. I said, well, people are the key to success or failure. I've never worked in the HR function. I want to work in HR because I feel like that is the most impactful and efficient way for me to drive change in an organization, because I am kind of the people's people in that context. So I set out to work in the field of HR. And I got flat out rejected. I would not get jobs because I was an engineer with finance and ops in 2008 when I didn't know employee relations. How could I do HR, right? And I was also part frustrated with the partnership I was getting with my HR team at the time, because it was the business acumen was not there. So I was trying to I was frustrated essentially. So I said, rather than complaining, let me try and be the small change in my own way and see what it's about. Long story short, since I did not get a role in HR, I quit and started my own consulting company, which was focused on HR technology and analytics, something I had done in my previous journey. And that's how I started my career off in HR. I did that I ran my own company for about 3 years, and I started three companies in 3 years at the same time in parallel. Two were successful, one failed miserably, and I learned more from it than probably the successes as well. And at the end of that 3 year span, I said, now I found my calling. I want to work in the people profession. I see there is a need for someone like me to bring operational excellence, business acumen, kind of the customer experience of HR, which now eventually couple years after I started doing, got to be known as employee experience. That was not even a term right back then. And the rest has been just history. So everything in my HR career has also been, the first 4 years was textbook HR. I did every single role from recruiting to learning to HR BP at one company that I was at to get that training, if you will, on the job training. And then it ended up being throughout my career, even at Airbnb, as you mentioned. So I went from the first HR role over 4 years. I went from my first HR job, which was over 4 years in all the disciplines of HR, to JLL, where I did textbook HR. What is it like to serve 50,000 employees with a team of 60 running everything? And that was more for the experience and credibility of being a people leader in a large space, because all my prior experiences were not in HR, in leadership roles. And then I came to Airbnb, where I was there for 5 years up until early last year. I think what made me successful, or what made my program successful at Airbnb, was the fact that I would continue to incubate programs that no one in HR had done before. And obviously, things like the pandemic put a lot of stress and opportunities, I would say, on things that were not done before. And I was always the one that would put my hand up and say, I don't know how to do it. If I can get some support, let me incubate it. If it does well, we'll make it a full-fledged program. I did that in addition to running my core people operations team that I was brought on there for. And that led to things like the Live and Work Anywhere program at Airbnb, which got really famous. But that was after a 15-month incubation of a team that I stood up that studied tax treaties, privacy laws. And we didn't incubate it with the idea or even thought of this will become something big. We just incubated it. We solved for a problem at that time, which was employees wanted to travel around the world and we wanted to support them and remain compliant at the same time, because we were not yet public. We were preparing to go public, so we had all eyes on us, so we could not just turn a blind eye. Yeah. And eventually it was the magic of realizing one day that this program can actually tie directly to our frontline business of Airbnb. Once we connected that dot, the rest was history, because it was a win-win scenario. It was something where employees wanted, something that drove business, because as people would travel and live and work anywhere around the world, we were expecting them to stay in Airbnbs because we had the supply of homes, right? So did that for 5 years. And then to your point, it's been a little under a year. I came to Paper, which is an education technology company. It's a new space from an experience standpoint, but I wanted to look for something that the mission was very, very deep and relatable both to me and to the general. In this particular case, I've been thankful to have had education from my undergrad, and then I did my MBA, and then I did like an exec coaching certification. I've done a live sound engineering. I keep every 3 years I go for some learning opportunity, be it in media or whatnot. Paper essentially is an education platform for K through 12 in the US, only in public schools, to help really reduce the inequality gaps that public school students may have relative to private school students, and really provide that end-to-end learning experience from K through 12 so that we can prepare kids to have confidence for life after school. And what better than, you know, working on a mission that really is helping build the next generation? And even if we make an inch of change, that could have a really big impact.
When you think about Q doing financial transformation way back when, what did you know then that still feels true today? And what is something you did not understand?
So when I started my job in finance transformation at Deloitte, Deloitte wanted to hire engineers that did not want to do engineering. That was their whole philosophy, because the idea was we will teach you what you need to learn on the job, so we don't expect you to know it. The flip side of that was, it was a little bit of, and I mean this with all respect, I love Deloitte and it's a great company, but consulting in those early days for me was a little bit of fake it till you make it. Yeah. I was a finance transformation consultant. I would go with individuals to clients and I would be pitched as this PeopleSoft financial expert. And I didn't even know what PeopleSoft was. The amazing beauty of working at a company like Deloitte, which I'm so thankful for in terms of, especially as a first job, was they poured in all the support and training on the back end once you got that project. You know, so I still remember my first project was like, what is PeopleSoft? And I'm an expert. How am I going to do this? But then I became an expert in 9 months of doing it. I think now it's, I know what I don't know, but I embrace it and try and figure it out. So it's not like I'm saying, all right, like I'm an expert at future work and remote work and I should be able to do it. I just dove into it at Airbnb, figured it out, worked through complexities. And then I eventually became an expert in remote work because of all the work I had to put in.
You mentioned wanting to get into HR, not being able to get hired into any role. And most people would be like, if HR doesn't want me, I guess that's not the case. Most people wouldn't respond to that and say, well, I'm actually just going to go start a company. What is it, do you think, that you understand about the world that other people may not?
I think it really stems from wanting to be an entrepreneur and being able to control what you want to achieve to the extent you can yourself. My dad, he's retired now, but he only ran his own businesses his entire life. And he always told me growing up, like, don't work for anyone. Figure out your own stuff. Be self-sustainable. Figure out a business. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it is. So I think that itch was always there and still is still today, which is why I'm back on like startup early stage, like trying to figure out what product market fit is like. So to me, I think it was a combination of wanting to do something on my own, but more importantly, that push, that final push off the ledge to do it came from, I just get so fired up when people tell me you cannot do something. And I don't know, now that you mention it, perhaps that is tied to the athlete in me, because when I mentioned that I reached the national level of swimming, which is the highest level in India, I reached that when I was in ninth grade. But I trained for it, I feel like, for 12 years leading up to that. That was my end goal, but I never got to it till I was like 14, right? So I think for me, like, I kept pushing because it was such a low odds of making it at that level that I wanted to fight the odds. And I think fighting the odds is kind of what I think pushed me to start my own company, in combination with my dad and a lot of my family run their own businesses. And I've always wanted to try it out. So when I started my own company, I was in my mid-20s. I said, I have about 9 months of saving. I'd broken my 401k as well when I talk about my savings. So, you know, not the, one could argue, not most fiscally prudent decision, but, you know, that's what I had to do it. And I said, I'm going to give myself 6 months. If I do not get where I want to be, or if I do not make any income in 6 months, I'll go back to Deloitte or Aon where I worked, because I had left on good terms. They're not going anywhere. Sure enough, in my second month, I got my first client and the rest kind of moved on. But I think just taking that dive into the deep end, for lack of a better analogy, in the swimming analogy, and just, if you don't make it or it does not work out the way you want, you can always course correct. And what I've always felt is like, life is too short to keep complaining or procrastinating for a decade. So when I get my mind on something and I really want to do it, I obsess about it.
was it like being at Airbnb in 2019, in 2020, and 2021?
So I'll give you for each of those years, because it was it had a different impact. So 2019 was the year of the highs. I joined summer 2018 and we were about 2,800 people. And by end of 2019, we were almost 8,000 people. So 2019 was the year of hypergrowth. Turn into 2020. The start of 2020 was getting ready to file our S1 to go public finally. Yeah. And right before we do that, the pandemic hits. And that was, I would say, a year of humility and rebound, if two things come to mind. So humility, because our entire business stopped in Q2, right? $1 billion a quarter just came to a standstill. From coming off a high in 2019 of hypergrowth to hoping to go public, and then dipping so down, it was really tough. It was also the hardest point in my career and my personal life, because in May of 2020, we led a really large layoff that you may have heard about. We were first in line, right? And we had to do a really big layoff, about 2,200 people in across 30 countries. And I had to lead that across all the countries from an operational standpoint. And we did it in a way that was not the norm. We wanted to go above and beyond in terms of personalizing conversations, in terms of what we offered to take care of folks. And then the first half was kind of humility and resilience. The second half, essentially, we came around Q3 with turning it around as the world decided Airbnbs is better than a big hotel with COVID still being there and for hygiene purposes and all that. And December of 2020, we had an amazing IPO. Yeah. And then the year of 2021, I would say, was the year of being grown up. And what I mean by that is, because things were getting better, we were killing in terms of business and numbers post IPO, the numbers were great. We still did not revert back to the crazy hypergrowth times. We were very, very disciplined on hiring slow or thoughtfully, to the extent where we did not want to put ourselves in a situation that if the market turned, we had to do another layoff, because that was very hard to deal with emotionally for everyone in the organization, not just on my own personal level. And then beginning of 2022 was another high moment, which was our Live and Work Anywhere program, which we announced, which was a 15-month incubator. So in August of 2020, I incubated a program called Global Nomad Program. We had employees that were going around the world, and we had two options. We said, we just turn a blind eye, or we tell them you can't do it, and they'll probably still do it, but we won't know about it. And that's fine. In typical Airbnb fashion, which aligned with my kind of thinking through the years, was, no, we're going to do what's best for our employees and for us. And if it's the hard route that no one has taken before, that's enough to motivate us and say, let's do it. So I stood up this program, which was studying. And obviously, I always have got the right support from leadership, because otherwise I would not have been successful in anything I do. We augmented with tax treaty consultants, privacy consultants, and we started letting people travel. But we would ask them where they're going, do this intake assessment study, and then tell them they can go. After doing that for 15 months, we realized we can actually build this for scale, and we can do it in a way that will directly impact our business to continue to grow.
You mentioned how important it was for you guys to do layoffs differently. A desire to make them more humane, a desire to come across more generous. Why?
We always wanted to live by our own guiding principles, which was, in this case, even if people are leaving, you have to treat them with just as much respect as you are hiring them, in some ways, because they could be guest or host on our platform as well. Challenging the status quo was the Airbnb DNA. One of our core values was be a serial entrepreneur, and serial was the box of cereals, because that's what our founders, back in, I think, 2009, when they had $40,000 of debt and they were pretty much in a really bad financial shape, they figured out they could hot glue cereal boxes and sell it at conventions, the presidential conventions. And they made so much money off that they paid off all their debt. So one of our core values is be a serial entrepreneur, meaning like figure out creative solutions. So that was one. And the second one was, I mean, I have to give credit to Brian Chesky, right? Like, he, as a leader, stepped in and said, I don't care if no one's done this. I want to do it this way. And I think for someone like me that thrives in that environment, I was able to push myself so much that I was able to come up with solutions that I would have honestly not done if I was in the realm of doing it in the constraints of how we did it. So a tactical example is Workday, which is our HRIS system. I had to trick it into doing writing personalized summaries for everyone that was impacted by tricking the compensation module, because it could do the same thing in philosophy. Like, you give comp statements, you know, who would have thought of that? And then I think the tail end, which is what we opened with, like, no pain, no gain, or going through that pain for a sense of reward or satisfaction, was we knew that if we did this right, not only would it be great for our employees, but we could actually help others with how we did it and set an example. And that's what we did with the open letter that was outsourced the day we did it. And I must have spoken to so many companies that still refer to that letter to date. We listed out exactly what we did, how we did it. That is a sense of accomplishment, that not only did you take care of your own employees, but you took care or you helped influence or inspire other companies as well.
What is your crystal ball on what remote work in particular, or the future of work, will look like over the next 5 to 10 years?
My own thoughts are that the future of work is going to be powered by the choice and flexibility that employees need. And I think we've got into the pandemic, if there was a silver lining through that, it's got into what I would refer to as like work-life harmonization. So it's not really a balance of one versus the other. You go to work, you leave it when you come home. Yes, it is for some, depending on your type of work. But it's really, how can you integrate life into work and how can you do it the other way around? So for example, some days I'm with my son if he comes back early and I spend 3 hours with him in the early evening, but then I'll get on my laptop after he goes to sleep and do work. It's kind of all part of one. I also think that there is a lot of copycatting or doing it because someone else is doing it without really understanding, does it apply to your business model? And is that something your people or employees want? If I am at an organization that is, for example, in healthcare or in essential services, remote work will not work. And that's okay. Like, I think what really frustrates me, especially a year and a half after or into this remote work saga, if you will, is that everyone feels that what they are doing is the best and only way to work. And I think the future of work, if I reiterate what I was thinking, the future of work is what works best for an organization and for the employees of that organization. It could be remote, it could be hybrid, it could be completely in person. I was talking to a founder a couple of months ago. He had a team of 20 or 25 people, Series A fairly early. And they all lived in close proximity of each other. They would go into the office and do brainstorming and design and all that fun stuff. And he was asking me, he was like, I really want to enable remote work, but I don't know how to do it because we love coming in and we are not still in product market fit early days. And my response to him was like, why are you trying to do it? Well, everyone's doing it. We should be able, you know, we should support it. In that example, I said, embrace what works for you. If your employees love coming in, if that's what you guys are working on at this point in time, like, just own it, embrace it, and go with it. So I think there is no crystal ball, is what I'm saying. As much the crystal ball for me depends on what the business needs are, what business and environment the business is operating in. But I think no matter whichever way you look at it, I do think there's an element of remote work. Like, pre-pandemic, before remote work was like a big thing in terms of like the headlines, my point is it always existed. I used to work 2 days a week pre-pandemic at home because my teams were in APAC in Europe, and I'm up late night or I'm up early morning. So remote work is not new in terms of having some factor of remote work. I think what the pandemic really helped is make it mainstream, make it more acceptable.
You're currently the chief people officer at Paper. What are the big trends in K-12 education that Paper is betting on right now?
The fundamental bet we're making is the fact that if we empower students to be confident and have a good and enriched learning journey, they will be set up for a better future. This does not mean going to college. This could be having their own career without going to college, in fields that there are tons of opportunities in those disciplines as well, in terms of micro-credentials and so on and so forth. The fundamental thing is that if we provide more than we used to provide just tutoring, now it's end-to-end kind of a support platform. So we provide reading, math activities, tutoring, as well as college or career readiness prep. That if we can just provide students with more opportunities to have a better education at an earlier age, it will pay off later on in their lives. And the hope is it'll hopefully make society an inch better than it was before. Because, you know, every generation has moved the needle a little bit more than the previous generation, be it in technology, be it in whatever field you look at. So if we can just create that foundation for society to be better, we do believe the bet is education can get us there. And there's a lot of impact studies, right? Like the size of a state prison is built based on the literacy rate of third graders in that state. But there's tons of examples like that, that we do impact studies that continues to just reinforce that if you help education at an earlier age, it sets a lot of things up for success for the individual and in turn for society. So that's the big bet. We've expanded our offerings and continue to focus only on public schools. You know, we only sell to public schools. So it's not selling directly to students, so that if the school purchases it, everyone in the school has it. That's part of the making sure that no matter what your socioeconomic statuses, you get access to paper.
You know, you mentioned earlier that when you decided to start a business, you didn't start one, you started three. And that desire to have your hands in multiple pots has never left. You started the People GPT community. It's not surprising that you're excited about this, but you haven't just been excited about this as a project on your own. You felt excited enough to really pull together a global community. Why go after the community aspect of it?
I think this goes back all the way to my comment earlier that when I was doing engineering in undergrad, I did not like being in a lab doing things by myself. I wanted to do it with people. I wanted to learn from people because, you know, even in this AI, Gen AI space, when I spent a full weekend obsessing over the custom GPT builder when it came out, I realized that the opportunities to leverage this are pretty much infinite. And even though my brain goes in multiple places, I'm just one human being that is thinking of X number of use cases. So immediately my mind went to twofold. One is, how can I do this with more people so I can learn, we can share, we can kind of just have fun together. That's one. And then the second underlying theme was generally people leaders are not in their comfort zone when it comes to technology. It's not necessarily been a skill set that they may have had like I've had in engineering and stuff. So I wanted to make sure that we as a people function don't get left behind on what Gen AI can do, what are the possibilities, what's the dark side. So I wanted to start having the conversation with fellow leaders on this is what I'm learning. Bring in individuals that are experts to explain and break it down and dumbify it for us, because we're not machine learning scientists. But at the same time, how are we going to support different parts of the organization, engineering included, and our own function if we don't understand what this can do? I don't think Gen AI is going to replace humans completely, because you'll always have what I call a human in the loop. But I think it will replace people that don't understand it and adapt to it.
What's your favorite custom GPT right now?
I would say, I mean, obviously I'm biased, but my favorite one is the one I created, which took a lot of time to build. It's called WorkZen. And it basically converts any raging thoughts you might have into polite and productive emails to drive productivity and reduce burnout. And it's, you know, it's a GPT where you can just go in and be like, Q was so obnoxious in this meeting, I can't deal with him. And then it'll ask you if Q is a direct report manager or subordinate, and it'll help craft an email so that you can improve the ways of working. Also infuse it with a lot of Zen scriptures. So it infuses mindfulness in there. So it's like, take a breath, reflect on what happened, send the email tomorrow. That's my favorite one. But I mean, every day I find a new one and it just blows my mind. So there's a lot on the People GPT community page. I've put out all the community-built Gen AI custom GPTs for people to play with each other. So there's a lot of cool ones out there as well.
How do you think about your own time management? You mentioned work-life harmony, but literally, how do you time block your weeks?
You know, some weeks are better than others. So I don't do a great job at it consistently. That's something that I'm constantly trying to work on. But in general, what I do is, you know, I'm an early morning riser. So a lot of times I have like a 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. session where I power through specific tasks that I've collected. I do morning routine for my son every day. So I wake him up and get him ready and send him to school. When he comes back around 5 o'clock, 5 to 7, I pretty much try not to do any work and be with him till he goes to bed. You know, most of the times from about 7 to 10 or 7 to 11, I'm at it again. I typically sleep 5 to 6 hours a night. So 11 to 5 is a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's my weekdays. On weekends, I try to really unplug. And I've not been good at it, especially the first 6 to 9 months in the CPO role was extremely stressful, both in terms of market conditions and the role and adjusting. But one of my reflections after taking a full week off between Christmas and New Year's was I have to get better at it. So I'm starting to I got an app last week, which is task management. So I put things in it because sometimes when I want to do something, I just want to get it done. So now I'm training myself to put it in that. And I've also started this little thing. It's called a focus timer. You can basically set timers from 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And I'm trying where I put a timer and I focus on a specific task, move on to the next.
Let's go back to kind of Q starting off his career, Q today, and Q stepping into retirement. If you had to give one piece of advice to each of those people, what would it be?
On Q starting off my career, I would say don't stress running up the ladder and focus more on learning. I think I tried to do both, which somehow worked out, but I wish I did not stress as much on the next promotion and the next promotion, because eventually you get to that next level and you realize, well, that's, you know, I want the next one and it's continuing. Mm-hmm. And things organically work out if you just focus on learning. So today, I would tell myself somewhat similar, like continue to learn. But I think in today's context, I think it's a lot about giving back as well. You know, when I had not even got to Airbnb or broken into tech, I sent a lot of cold emails to LinkedIn folks or folks on LinkedIn. I still do that till today. I send cold emails to people that I look up to or and admire or want to connect with. And one of them is still my mentors and coaches still today. And he didn't have to even respond. He didn't even have to give me time. Stepping into retirement will be not just giving back, but really dedicating time to driving an impact in whatever field. So I'm obviously, education is something that's never going to leave me. You know this, once you start, you know, in the field of education and you are passionate about it. So perhaps education, perhaps just nonprofits, but really picking what my passion area is. I don't know what it is. So maybe my advice to myself going to retirement is figure out what that calling is in terms of not just giving back, but now being part of that in a more full-time basis in terms of driving that mission. So I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, but that's a good one. I think I'm going to sleep over that and continue to think through it. But I would say really find my calling, if you will. And I don't mean like HR is my calling, something more deeper than that.
And now we've come to one of my favorite parts of the podcast, our recurring spoken story segment, when we hear from the people who know our guests best. This week, we get to talk to three people leaders who have worked and are deep fans of Q. There's AJ Thomas, a chaos pilot / people leader at Google X. Andrew Bartlow, who's actually a previous guest on our podcast. He's the managing partner at People Leader Accelerator. And we also have Jennifer Goldfarb, the people and culture manager at BDO. Here's what each of them had to say when I asked them the question, what exactly is Q Hamirani's superpower? Let's hear what they had to say.
Hey, everyone. So Q's superpower is he's an engineer. Tried and true. He has the power to break down very complex problems into their discrete parts and then figure out how to connect the entire system together. And he does this in his personal life, in his professional life, in the work that he does, in the writing that he does. It's absolutely impressive.
Q is fearless. He seeks challenge. That includes public speaking, working with AI, and diving into big, hairy jobs. From HR ops at Jones Lang LaSalle to Work Anywhere Airbnb, and now the top HR job at Paper, which is a lot bigger than a typical people role. He focuses on growing, coming first with curiosity, rather than letting fear or self-doubt get in the way.
I would say that Q's superpower is that he's a puzzle master. He has a knack for unraveling complex situations, helping you think through those situations with clarity, and then finding a creative solution. And the questions that he asks make you feel like you were the one to solve the problem anyway.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Venture Visionaries. As I reflect on my conversation with Q, I'm mostly struck by how often Q asks why not, where people would ask why. How willing he is to be a student and dive into spaces that he knows nothing about, armed with few resources other than a deep curiosity and a relentless passion to do the work. And how again and again, armed with these two things, he builds beautiful, big, bold, career-transforming programs. My hope for you, dear listener, this week is that you would have a moment where you would ask yourself why not when you usually ask why. That the next time you enter a space that looks gray and unclear, where you find yourself curious about something but know that you don't have the tools or skills to ace it, at least not in the beginning, that you would ask why not rather than why and simply dive in. The world needs more Q Hamiranis. The world needs more you. Have a great week. As always, I'm Thomas.